the challenge from diversity to pluralism. That's the challenge of our age. That actually is the challenge of your generation. I'm Diana Eck. I'm off there on the right. And like many people in my university and at universities around the country, I encounter religious diversity just about every day. In the next office to mine is my friend on the left, that's Ali Asani, who is here with me as we're entertaining another friend, Hamza Peres, right between us, who's a Latino Muslim who had just screened his new film called The New Muslim Cool. Now this term, the 10 students who are in my sophomore religion seminar are Christian and Buddhist, Jewish, Jain, Muslim, and none. All of those things. Religious and cultural diversity is simply the sea that we swim in these days. Now, we also know, and I'm not going to show them here, that there are horrific images of today's world, that of violence, and too often, violence in the name of religion. It jolts us, it forces us into what I think are some of the deepest questions of the humanities. Now, when I was in college, there was another war, a couple of them really, but that's when I started taking religion seriously as something I needed to know about. Our newspapers then carried horrific images of the war in Vietnam, a part of the world about which I, as a college student, knew almost nothing. Americans as a whole knew almost nothing. But as a nation, we were at war there. I remember this image, newspaper, a Vietnamese Buddhist monk, Thich Quang Duc, who sat down calmly one day in the main intersection of Saigon, poured gasoline over himself, entered into deep meditation, and set himself on fire. Now this got the attention of the world, demonstrating in his own body the deep suffering being caused by a war in which neither side was paying attention to the people and the human cost of this polarizing violence. Well, that got my attention too. I wanted to know more. I wanted to know something about Asia. I signed up for a year study program. It was the only one I could find in Asia then. It was in India, not Vietnam, but close enough. And that was the first step. It was in the city of Benares, on the Ganges in North India, one of the great sacred cities of the Hindus and a place that I've returned to dozens of times since then. Now, I was a young Christian girl, grew up Methodist in Montana. I don't pray waist deep in the Ganges, but here I encountered a very deep spirituality of people whose traditions of faith were not my own, but it was something I could recognize because of my own. This is, I think, the great adventure of the humanities, to understand not just facts and texts and theologies of something that we might call Hinduism or Buddhism, but to understand what they mean to the people for whom they are life-orienting. And that was it. How do people live their lives and raise their children and die their deaths in the context of religious worlds that we ourselves do not share? That's the challenge of the humanities. And I've lived and grown with that ever since. We're not all the same. And the encounter with religious difference is really where pluralism begins. This is a woman I met that year. Her name is Shanti. I've seen her dozens of times since then, including just last January. This is her daughter, Monica, who was born that year, who was a baby when I first met her. And she too, people whose life stories we have come to know over the course of many years. This also is the challenge of the humanities. Now we know today that the encounter with religious worlds of meaning that are perhaps not our own, or may be our own, like this sick gentleman in New York. But this is part of our world today in ways that were unimaginable to me when I first went to India. Since the 1965 Immigration Act opened the door to new immigration in the US, the religious landscape of America has changed. Of Harvard has changed too. Now, just this year, everyone was observing the 50-year anniversary of Selma. And of course, last year, the historic Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. But this year now, 2015, we observe the 50-year anniversary of a third piece of legislation. In October, when you're here, we'll talk about the 1965 Immigration and Nationalities Act. As Robert Kennedy, who was our Attorney General then, said, we can't be working to eliminate race discrimination in every aspect of our national life and still have it as the foundation of our immigration policy, which it was. That was signed into law by Lyndon Johnson at the base of the Statue of Liberty, and he said when he signed it something we have to be somewhat amused about. He said, this bill which we signed today is not a revolutionary bill. It won't affect the lives of millions. It won't reshape the structure of our daily life or really add importantly to either our wealth or our power. I think he had no idea what the Silicon Valley and MIT would look like in 50 years. But still, he said, it is one of the most important acts of this Congress because it corrects an enduring wrong in the conduct of the American nation. And that's right, it did correct an enduring wrong in the conduct of the American nation. And as for me, I dove into the study of India, into the study of texts and rituals and people, and I had no idea that when I surfaced, I would find myself in Boston, in the suburbs of Boston, where they were dedicating Hindu temples right in my own backyard. I had no idea how much the immigration that came with this piece of legislation would change the field of study that I undertook. And for the first time, that we the people of the United States of America, has changed radically. People from all over the world. They're dedicating temples in the Boston suburbs with the waters of the Ganges mixed with the waters of the Mississippi. People who brought not only their Qurans and their Bhagavad Gitas and their Bodhisattva Guanyins and their images of Our Lady of Guadalupe brought all of that with them to America and have given us a new religious America. So in the 90s, I launched the Pluralism Project with Harvard students, with students and faculty from across the country to explore and interpret this new religious landscape of our country. We had students all over Boston. We created a religious atlas of Boston, and we did that for cities and towns across the country. Here, one of our affiliates in Minnesota doing a study of the Hindu temple in Maple Grove outside Minneapolis. So we had three kinds of research questions. First, who's here in our cities and towns? We didn't really know. Second, how are these religious traditions, like Buddhism here, changing as they take root in American soil, changing as Cambodian monks and laity now take a casket with a bone relic of the Buddha to enshrine in South Carolina? And finally, how's America changing in the light of this new immigration as we graduate from college in mortarboards and hijabs? Those were our questions. They're still our questions. The demographic changes of America have been spectacular in the past 50 years. We think about identity, national, regional, colleges and universities, corporations and public spaces. Who are we anymore? How do we deal with our differences? For religious difference, cultural difference is increasingly part of our lives in multi-religious societies. In his first inaugural address, President Obama spoke of America as a patchwork people, a nation, he said, of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, non-believers, shaped by every language on earth and drawn from every end of this earth. But it's also a challenge, a real challenge, an ongoing challenge for us. We don't want to erase our differences. We don't want to insist that everyone look alike, but in and through differences, to create a vibrant society. And that's what pluralism really is about. Not the erasure of difference, not the laissez-faire acceptance of difference, but the challenge of difference. And those people who dedicated themselves to shaping our Bill of Rights and talked about the free exercise and the non-establishment of religion probably didn't imagine the religious diversity of America as we have it today, but they've given us 16 simple words in that First Amendment to the Constitution that have shaped the way we've dealt with religious difference ever since. And so we are Hindus who have built landmark temples in Pittsburgh, temples in Calabasas, California, and in dozens and dozens and dozens of other cities in the US. Gujarati Hindus, now Americans, who have built landmark temples in London and Atlanta and Houston. And the neighbors of other faiths that we have are not imaginary people on the other side of the world, but people across the street in our own town, our family, our class at Harvard. And speaking of Harvard, where the Holy Springtime Festival is observed by Harvard Hindu students and their friends by the hundreds, literally, as it was. They had to postpone the Springtime Festival this year because it was winter most of the time when Holi came. But it just took place a week ago in the Mac Quad. And it is one of Harvard's great yearly events now, as is the show that South Asian students put on, the annual blockbuster cultural program called Gunguru, showcasing the dance and music and drama of their parents, sometimes homelands, often mixed with humor and fusion in their own drum beats and dance traditions. And we Americans are also Buddhist. Many cultures who have become part of America's multicultural mix here in a small Vietnamese temple in Seattle, for example, or a Cambodian Buddhist community here, this one is in Lynn, but it could be in any number of the northern suburbs of Boston, or Chinese immigrants who have created temples in Quincy, the birthplace of John Quincy Adams, just a stone's throw away, and gathering on the weekend from all the suburban areas of Boston for worship at the Thousand Buddha Temple. And just last fall, the Thai Buddhists created the largest Thai temple outside Thailand in the whole wide world, right here in Raynham, just a few miles south of Boston. But at Harvard as well, you might find yourself in a class with a Buddhist monk right here, or with a Buddhist nun trying to negotiate the snows of Cambridge, or with other students who meditate weekly in the Adams Upper Common Room. And then the Muslim tradition. Muslims have broken ground for new mosques and Islamic centers all across the country. This one right out in Sharon, not so far away, on an old horse farm, now an Islamic center, a school, and here a rabbi, an Orthodox archbishop, etc., all turning a shovel of dirt for that new Islamic center. And of course, you've seen some of the others, on a cornfield outside Toledo, or in the suburbs of Cleveland, or perhaps in Jacksonville, Florida, or in a thousand other places in New York, like this one, the corner of 96th and 3rd, the largest of dozens and dozens of Islamic centers and storefront prayer rooms throughout the boroughs of the city. And here in Boston, we lived through the creation of our first big landmark Islamic center down in Roxbury Crossing, where Salma Kazmi here, their community relations person, led civic leaders, anyone who had questions, through the building process week after week as the mosque went up, and there it is. We watched that mosque rise from the ground up, a brick mosque with its own sort of Boston feel to it, and Boston's then Mayor Menino involved in the dedication of that mosque. And inside, in case you want to visit down in Roxbury Crossing, there's the Common Word Cafe, where you can have a cup of coffee. Here at Harvard, of course, Lowell Lecture Hall is set up for Friday Jummah prayers virtually every week, crowded. The daily prayer space is in the basement of Canaday. And you might study with Usman Khan, who teaches courses on Islam in Africa, or perhaps with Leila Ahmed, who teaches women's studies in Islam. You might go with roommates and blockmates, a Muslim roommate perhaps, to an event discussing the legacy of Malcolm X. This is the kind of university that you would come to, a university that is teeming with the cultural and religious difference of our culture. And of course, the landmarks in America's history are many. Here's Keith Ellison, the first Muslim elected congressman from the state of Minnesota, taking his oath of office on a copy of the Quran that was owned by Thomas Jefferson, and Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, taking her oath of office on the copy of the Bhagavad Gita she carried with her as an officer in the armed services in Iraq. And, well, Susan Brooks, an Indiana congresswoman, here visiting a Sikh Gurdwara in Indianapolis, her first trip to a Gurdwara, giving us a sense that immigration has changed the face of America. And immigration from Latin America, to be sure, Catholic and evangelical, has changed the face of Christian America. And change has been part of every religious community in America. And Native peoples, with their own diversity across the country, are important contributors to our ongoing conversation. All over the world, people encounter the realities of religious difference. Muslims encounter black evangelical traditions, for example, and non-Sikh Americans encounter the realities of a complex headgear in a tie-the-turban day. Now, let's be honest, many of us in this American we aren't too fond of religion at all, and that may include many of you in this incoming class. Nonetheless, I'd like to say that all of us inevitably are involved in the work of pluralism, learning to live with religious difference, learning to live with people whose backgrounds and deepest traditions they may not understand. Even atheists, for example, have to live in a world, the world that we create, the world of religious and cultural difference. And worldviews collide, chasms open, walls are deliberately built, and all of us need to know more about the religious energies of our world than most of us do. No mosques, no minarets, as this sign indicates? Well, okay, but fear is surely no foundation for the age of pluralism that we live in. So what is pluralism? I say a few things about it. First, that it's not diversity alone. Diversity is just a word. Diversity is just a fact. But the energetic engagement with diversity. Second, that pluralism isn't just tolerance, because tolerance is in some ways too thin a foundation for the kind of world we live in today. But the active seeking of understanding across lines of difference. And there are so many opportunities for that at Harvard, whether it's in roommate groups, whether it's in classes, whether it's over lunches. Finally, pluralism isn't just relativism, not a kind of sort of world in which all cats are gray and all the same. No, pluralism really begins with difference and with the encounter of commitments. You don't have to leave your commitments at the door to encounter people of different commitments. And finally, that pluralism is based on dialogue. It's based on that kind of language of give and take and listening and speaking that is absolutely essential, essential to friendship and essential to relationship. So in our research, the Pluralism Project studies the changing landscape of America. We still have dozens of students who volunteer to spend their summer as interns for us all across the country. But the work of pluralism isn't just the work of the Pluralism Project, it's your work, it's our work. It's the work of places all over the country where the future home of a Methodist church and the future home of a masjid are side by side. And that's what our world looks like. That's what it will look like from now on. And so I invite you to that challenge of moving from the sheer fact of diversity to the engagement of difference in a world of pluralism. Thank you very much.